Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, August 29th. I'm Ray Graff. Today it's astronomy. We welcome back Valerie Rapson to talk about this topic. If you have a question about Mars and Jupiter and being close together, comets, gravity, the background light of the universe, give us a shout, 800-348-2551. Apparently, scientists now have figured out how dark is dark. All they would have had to do is come in on a Monday morning to the newsroom, and they would have known that. 800-348-2551 is our number. You can also email voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org, or 800-348-2551. If you have an astronomy question today, Dr. Valerie Rapson, and your calls coming up after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. We have our astronomer. Well, one of the two is here today. There was a late scratch on your race card. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here today, assistant professor of physics at astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her PhD in astrophysical science and technology at the Rochester Institute of Technology. If you have a question for Dr. Rapson, give us a shout. 800-348-2551, 800-348-2551. You can email as well, voxpop@wamc.org. voxpop@wamc.org is the email, and the number is 800-348-2551. Dr. Valerie Rapson, how are you?
Oh, doing great. How are you?
How's the school? You got underway yet?
Yeah. We just started on Monday, so I'm slowly getting back into the groove of classes every day, all day.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's been fun.
How are the kids?
They're excellent.
Yeah?
Yeah. I get to teach basic physics, algebra-based physics this semester, and one of our kind of middle-level astronomy classes. So I have a large group of students, and they're all really fantastic.
Now, as you progress, if you are going to continue and make astronomy your thing, mm-hmm. the math must just get insane after a while.
It does, yeah. And I mean, even I like reached a point where I was like, I don't understand this math anymore. and that's really, I mean, there's different options in astronomy, though. You can become an observational astronomer, which is more like what I did, where you're taking pictures, you're analyzing the data, or you could be the more math-heavy theoretical astronomer who's doing the new calculations and deriving new theories and stuff. And that's a little too advanced for me. I really like the taking the pictures and trying to find evidence of the theorists' ideas.
I mean, that's direct gratification.
Mm-hmm.
If you're doing the math and coming up with the theories, it's sort of an indirect gratification.
Yeah, and then you've got to hope that somebody can take a picture that proves that you're correct. And this is more like, no, I actually see something and I can describe it, and it's just super cool.
How's the planetarium?
Oh, it's a lot of fun. I had an awesome graduate student this summer, Mackenzie. She actually designed and created an entire planetarium show on her own. So she wrote the script, she recorded the voiceover, she designed the visuals, and she even hand drew some of it for the show. And she's basically putting it together. So starting in later September, we're going to actually play her show on the show schedule.
This is amazing. Now, to write the script, first of all, let's answer that question, and then let's go back to the days before computers and how they did planetariums.
Yeah.
But if you're writing the script, you have to position all the stars and all the planets in one spot? I mean, in the correct spots?
Yeah, well, I mean, nowadays we have computers and it's all programmed, so all you have to do is type in the date, location, and time that you want, and it will display it automatically for you. And you're basically writing a code that is going to then, you know, change from one position in the sky to another and pop up Mars when you want it to be there. So it kind of programs itself in that respect.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, I mean, back in the day when we were using more mechanical star balls, like you had to turn the knobs and you had to wait for them to spin. And I remember when I was in Rochester, I worked at the Strassenberg Planetarium, and there was always a little note that said, you know, don't leave the diurnal motion knob cracked. Because if you did that, that would make the mechanical device spin as if a day was going by. And if you left it overnight, you'd be in the year like 1500 and something.
Oh, so cool.
And you'd have to wait like 8 hours of the knob turned for it to get back. Like, it wasn't digital. There was no way to fix it. You just had to wait for it to fix itself.
It's pretty neat. You know, you can go as far in the future as you want with these now. Yeah.
Yeah. Our system will go a million years into the future or past, and it will do all the positions of the stars, the moons, the planets, all accurately, give or take a million years. It's really awesome.
I saw an article somewhere today that, and it might be a couple of weeks old now, that they're theorizing that the asteroid that allegedly killed the dinosaurs came from outside the solar system.
Yeah. They're trying to basically look at the size of the crater and the elements that are in the ground or near the water of the actual crater that we can see, and they're trying to figure out, you know, exactly where it came from, and it might be from literal outer space.
That's amazing. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. The number is 800-348-2551. We have been watching with delight this dance that Mars and Jupiter have been doing in the sky, getting closer, and you see Aldebaran over there on the side.
Mm-hmm.
And I got thinking about how the ancients figured this stuff out, because they could predict how these things would move, and yet Mars and Jupiter are very far apart.
Yeah.
And presumably, and I don't know about orbital velocities or anything, but I assume they go at different speeds.
Mm-hmm.
Jupiter's orbit's a lot bigger. How did they do it? How did the ancients do it without really any huge observation device except their eyes?
Right.
It's amazing.
It really just boils down to time and patience and very accurate drawings. Because if you were to draw the position of a planet relative to the other stars every single night, you go outside, you make a very accurate sketch, you'll notice that the planets are going to move against the stars. That's how we recognize that they were planets in the first place. And if you watch, Mars, since it's closer to the sun, is going to move faster than Jupiter. And that kind of clues you into some relative distances between all of these planets.
But how did they know at that time that, oh, if it's moving faster, it's closer? How'd they figure that out?
Well, they had those accurate observations, and it took Kepler to come up with his laws of planetary motion, where he actually had the equation that says, you know, if you are this distance from the sun, then you're going to move at this speed, at this rate, at this period, and you could kind of put the numbers together. But it really was all based on just simple observations through, you know, with your eyes or through those early telescopes.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is here. The number is 800-348-2551. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. If you have a question today about astronomy, you sent a couple of great articles today. And these are, I think, both from the Hubble website. Yeah.
The
deep space probe measures all the background light in the universe. First line is a grabber. How dark is dark? Explain what this means. I thought space was black.
Yeah, it's just dark, right?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, we all look outside at night and we see the darkness of outer space, but astronomers really wanted to quantify it. And basically what they were trying to see is there any ambient light in the universe, like optical light that our eyes would see if we were sensitive enough to see it, beyond the solar system?
From galaxies or whatnot?
From anything. It could be something we know of, like galaxies, or it could be something we can't explain. Because if you think back to, like, the cosmic microwave background, that, you know, radio hum in the universe, nobody expected to see that, but when they pointed their telescopes, they just kept picking up this unexplained signal.
Yeah.
So we were testing this basically at optical wavelengths, and the only way to do that is to essentially get as far away from the sun, where it's as dark in the solar system as possible, look away from the sun, look away from as many stars as you can, and just try and take a picture. Measure how much light your camera detects. And they used the New Horizons spacecraft that went beyond Pluto to see it.
And so that's 5+ billion miles away at this time.
Oh, yeah.
But still technically in the solar system?
Yes, still
even
technically
though
in the solar system.
The dust from the solar system is no longer reflecting light, right?
Yeah, that's the idea, is that this spacecraft is far enough out where the dust is essentially non-existent. Because if I were to take a picture of the night sky tonight, you know, I've got the atmosphere, I got dust in the solar system that's going to scatter the light, and there will be this faint ambient glow that I would need to know how to remove if I wanted to compute, like, how dark the actual universe is. But if you have a spacecraft near the edge of the solar system where you don't have to deal with this stuff, then you can just look at the darkest part of space you can find and see if you're picking up any light. And the answer is they didn't see anything really, or what they did detect can be fully explained by the glow of distant galaxies. So no strange
no mysteries
light,
yeah,
that
time.
They were able to detect.
Now, how many more billions of miles will it take for New Horizons to go beyond the heliopause?
Oh, quite a while. I mean, we've got the Voyagers out there, and they're at like 160-something astronomical units, and New Horizons is at about 57,
so
I think.
So they have
a while. Yeah, it's going to be many, many years before New Horizons technically exits the solar system.
And the other article you sent, and by the way, Valerie Rapson, Dr. Rapson's our guest today. It's Astronomy, 800-348-2551 or voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get to the phone calls after the first break here in a moment. The other article, which it's more incomprehensible to me because this is not my field. Webb finds early galaxies weren't too big for their britches after all. What gives?
Yeah, I feel like we talked about this at some point a few months ago where, you know, we had these James Webb images, and what we were seeing when we looked really far away into space was too many galaxies, more than we expected. And they were also really bright, which meant that we thought that they were very massive. And we couldn't explain how a galaxy that's far away, that was formed in the very early universe, how it could have so many stars and be as large and bright as it appeared to be. So this was a big mystery for the last couple of months. And what astronomers were able to figure out is when we look at these distant galaxies, the light that we see is not primarily from stars. It's from really hot gas that's orbiting the black hole.
Aha.
So when we measure the material in these distant galaxies, we use something called the mass to light ratio. Very simply put, if you see one stellar brightness, the brightness of a sun, then you assume that there's one sun's amount of mass there. So you just kind of have this simple ratio, and you can adjust it if you need to.
Have they proven that assumption is correct?
For the nearby galaxies, yes, they can do that. And, you know, they have to adjust the ratio. It's not always exactly one-to-one, depending on what you're looking at. But that's the basic idea, to kind of give you a sense. But that's not true for these early galaxies, because the gases, which are not very much mass, not a lot of material at all, they're glowing as if they are tens or hundreds of times as bright as the sun. So it was kind of like a miscalculation of how much material was there. And that led us to think they were more massive than they were.
Does that mean that many calculations of distances in space have to be recalculated?
Not so much. This is a different theory than the whole calculating distances with like supernova and variables and stuff. This is just trying to understand how big, how massive the galaxies were when they literally fill like 3 pixels on your picture. You can't see the details, so you have to use other clues to try and estimate their sizes.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. It's Astronomy Today. We'll hit the phones and the emails coming up. 800-348-2551 is our number. VoxPop@WAMC.org is the email address. Little underwriting, little Stevie Ray Vaughan. How can you lose? Vox Pop on WAMC. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551, or you can email voxpop@wamc.org. Well, we touched on this when Nick wrote in a little while ago. A few weeks ago, I went out at 4 a.m. to unplug my bike. I looked up east, then did the movie version of a sleepy kid rubbing both eyes. Wowee, it was Mars, Jupiter, and the Taurus constellation sideways, so Aldebaran was right there. They all fit in the width of 2 thumbs, totally wild. Each night after, they were significantly farther apart.
Yeah.
So that was the key moment. I was very lucky. How often does this happen?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's really just dependent on where all the planets are in respect to each other. So right now we have Mars and Jupiter relatively close to each other. Jupiter and Saturn are going to start to get a little closer together, I think. So this happens quite frequently. And we always see those news articles of, you know, planetary alignment coming. And it just happens like all the time. There's always planets in a line up there. They just happen to be particularly close.
Yeah, it was very impressive to watch over a course of days. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. Jim is in Adams, Massachusetts. Hello there, Jim.
Hello, good afternoon. Yay, Ray, and yay, Dr. Rapson.
Yay.
Yes, my question is, I barely caught part of it, the star date on your radio program earlier, station earlier, saying that the moon and the two twin stars from the Gemini constellation will be visible tomorrow night. Hmm. I didn't get the positioning. One will be on one side and one will be on the other side of the moon, I guess.
Mm. Yeah, that'll be early in the morning because the moon's going to start rising. Yeah, we'll see that a little bit later in the evening, early in the morning. But in Gemini, you have Castor and Pollux, you know, the twin brothers in mythology. And it sounds like they said the moon's going to be right smack in the middle of those two stars.
Oh, cool.
So that'll be cool to see.
Yeah, that'll be very cool.
No idea which is on which side, though.
If I remember, now I'm probably going to get it wrong because I'm thinking.
Are you giving her a quiz? I mean, come on.
I was going to say Castor on the left and Pollux on the right, but don't quote me. So.
Well, I've got them opposite that right now, so I'll write them a different one now.
All right, Jim.
A quick search online will answer that question.
Any other major celestial events that are coming up you could give us a little bit of a date on?
Mm. Oh, a date. Okay.
Yeah, well, the planets are definitely going to be interesting to watch. You know, this summer we really didn't have any planets to look at, so everyone's excited to be able to see Saturn rising and all the other planets. From another exciting standpoint, we have to wait till March for a lunar eclipse. You know, we'll have the big meteor shower in December again, but nothing as exciting as like the solar eclipse last year. So we've got a little ways to wait.
All right, Jim, thank you very much for the call. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest today. It's astronomy. Dr. Rapson is a professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta, which is just underway. The kids are champing at the bit to get out there and look at those telescopes. Mm-hmm. Have you done that yet?
Yeah, so we just upgraded last year our 1 meter telescope and did some final work on it over the summer. So now it is fully functional. And I've been out doing some exoplanet observations these last few weeks, but the students just came back and I keep getting messages going, when are we going to the telescope? I want to check it out and learn how to use it again.
And how big is this telescope?
1 meter, 40 inches wide.
That's a lot of light.
It's the largest optical telescope in New York State, and it's really, you know, borderline amateur professional size. We can do a lot that many others can't with their telescopes.
Now, you do exoplanet observations with this.
Mm-hmm.
They're really far away. What can you see?
Yeah, so we can't see the planets orbiting the stars directly, but we can see when the planet crosses in front of the star and it blocks out 1% to 2% of the star's light, and we can actually detect that slight dimming once we process the data and graph it afterwards.
Okay, so this is an optical telescope?
Mm-hmm.
How are you then converting it to digital so that you can process and do these kind of observations?
Yeah, we've got a CCD camera, a special astronomical camera,
so
that's basically
both?
Measuring it.
So you have a CCD and a lens, or is it just a CCD?
Well, the telescope has the lenses and mirrors on the inside, and you can put a lens, you can put an eyepiece in if you just want to look. But we generally take pictures with the CCD in place of the eyepiece so that we can capture it and then actually, you know, save the data and analyze it later.
When you do that, is it available? In other words, if you have a screen like we have in here, mm-hmm. an LCD, can you see live? Basically, in other words, if you gather your students around and you had an eyepiece, it's one person to an eyepiece.
Right.
But if you have a screen, an HD,
right.
can you see it like that?
Yeah. So what we generally do is, you know, we've got a computer that controls everything now. So as the images come in, they pop up on screen. Now, if you're looking at something cool like a nebula or a galaxy, you can actually see it. And it's very impressive on the screen. But when we do our exoplanet work, it just looks like a star field every time. So the initial pictures don't look exciting. What's exciting later is when you actually measure the amount of light and you see that drop down in light for a couple of hours and then it goes back to normal. And then if you're a nerd like me, you get dorkily excited about, you know, a planet went in front. So it depends on, you know, what level of excitement you're talking about here.
So you're at PhD level excitement.
Yeah,
most of us.
Just a little bit.
All right, let's go back to the phones. Dr. Valerie Rapson's our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Tom's in Rhinebeck. Hello there, Tom.
Hey, how are you?
Good. Welcome.
Okay, my question is, if all these distant stars and galaxies and the light we see from them is millions and millions of light years distant and time-wise away from us, in the distant past, how do we have any idea what those things look like in real time today?
I love that.
Yeah, fabulous question. And the answer is we don't. We only are privy to the light that we can receive. So exactly like you alluded to, when we look at a star that's 10 light years away, we're seeing that star as it was 10 years ago. And if something has happened to it since then, we have to wait for that light, that change, to get to our eyes. So when I was just talking about looking at those exoplanets, right, they, you know, it's not happening in the moment that I'm watching necessarily. It happened a certain amount of time ago, and I'm just watching the light that's getting to my eyes and being able to see it at that moment. So we don't know what's happening right now. We only know what we can see from the light that they're emitting.
Or what's the possibility that those light sources are dead? There's nothing out there. Mm. They're all burnt out, and this is just, you know, old images we're seeing.
Yeah, well, most stars live for billions of years, and the likelihood that they were all going to die like tomorrow or something is very, very slim. So pretty much everything we see with our eyes, even though it's very distant, would still be there right now if we could magically see everything as it is in this moment. But generally speaking, you know, we'll be able to see the same stars for quite some time.
Okay. Tom, thank you.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Appreciate the call. Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest. 800-348-2551, the number. If you have an astronomy question today, or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. Some of these distant light sources, these galaxies, what's the furthest one we can see?
Well, we can look back almost to the beginning of the universe. So the oldest galaxies we've seen are like 13.5 billion light years away.
Isn't that over the usual lifespan of galaxies?
Well, yeah. So I guess some of those galaxies, they have probably dispersed somewhat. I mean, you have stars in them that will live to be trillions of years old, but
really,
they're generally a lot smaller and redder and fainter, so they're harder to see. So a lot of the bright blue stars that you're observing in the galaxy will be gone, but the galaxies themselves may still be there, just in a slightly different form.
Does light in a vacuum get tired? In other words, can there be a spot that's too far away? Redshift and blue shift notwithstanding.
Right, yeah, yeah.
Can it get, assuming there's nothing to block it, can light go forever?
Well, I mean, there's that idea of the tired light theory, where as light travels, it does lose energy, but there's not a lot of direct supporting evidence for that. I mean, people are still mathematically trying to figure that out and use that idea to explain some of what we would normally call redshift and blue shift. But there's not a lot of support for that. If light is just traveling through a vacuum unimpeded, it's going to travel at the speed of light and get to our eyes.
Forever. 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. Okay, as you understand it, we have talked about this many times before. Take us back to that first nanosecond after the Big Bang.
Yeah.
What happened?
It was hot.
It was hot.
It was very, very hot.
How did it get hot?
Well, that's the ultimate question. Like, whatever triggered the explosion, for lack of a better word, that created our universe, you know, something brought everything into this super hot existence. So the universe, everything that we could understand, was very, very small, very hot, and nothing was as it is today. So we didn't have, you know, protons, neutrons, electrons, atoms, none of that fancy stuff yet. We had to wait many years for the universe to expand and cool and for all those particles to actually form and condense into the material that we see today. So we're talking, you know, millions and millions of degrees in a very small space, and the universe was expanding, and light was being created and destroyed constantly. So until the cosmic microwave background, we were constantly getting photons created, photons destroyed, and back and
destroyed
forth.
Destroyed by what?
Well, they basically combine together. You can have electrons, and then you can smash them together. You can make photons, and you can kind of go back and forth. There's also, you know, the idea of absorbing energy into the vacuum of outer space. So there was a lot of that going on as well.
So
it was
space
a very weird time.
Space has absorbent qualities.
To some extent, yes.
How did the subatomic particles form? Okay, heat. I'll give you the heat.
Yeah, yeah.
I'll give you the heat at the very beginning. But then how does that turn into subatomic particles?
I mean, the idea is that just the material cooled and the quarks, the building blocks of like protons and electrons, they eventually settled out from this ambient heat, this ambient energy, and then they kind of naturally found each other and combined to form atoms. But the actual details, I think we're still trying to work out, because that starts to bridge the realm of astronomy and quantum mechanics, and we don't have that bridge built yet. We don't have that full understanding.
Where do you stand on the quantum mechanics?
Well, I mean, I definitely believe in it. It's awesome, but it's very complex. And we really, it's amazing how we can describe very accurately what's happening in the little realm, the quantum, the small realm. And it's amazing what we can do in the astronomy realm, the big realm. But putting the two together, you know, there is still that huge gap of how does one explain the other? And they're both coexisting in our universe. How do they connect?
So does that suggest a lack of understanding, or does that suggest a primary problem with the theory of the whole thing?
Well, I guess it could be both. You know, we usually think of it more as just a lack of understanding. We haven't found or fully observed the right kind of math and the right kind of theories that will describe it. But there's people on both sides. You know, some are coming up with completely new theories, new math. Others are just trying to find observational evidence for what we already have and can describe.
I cannot understand how this quantum fizziness will allow things to come in and out of existence.
Yeah,
to me, I can't understand it. And as far as the Big Bang goes, is that what really happened?
Yeah, I mean, your guess is as good as mine. I think we've got to, you know, find some quantum physicists and ask them those deep questions.
Yeah, unfortunately, my head would explode if we did that. So let's not. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson from SUNY Oneonta. Let's go over to Hudson, and we'll talk to Austin. Austin, you're on.
Hey, guys. So I guess I'm wondering, we can go back so far and kind of have some confidence that it is still there. You know, the sun is 8 seconds. Mm-hmm. We're pretty confident that's still there. How far back, when we're talking about 13 billion years and everything in between, how far back can we go with any sort of confidence of what is actually likely still present? And what may just be a total wild card, and we should probably disregard that conception of a physical model of the universe.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it depends on what kind of object you're looking at and what the lifespan of that object is, right? So smaller stars, they'll live for trillions of years. So if you're looking at a star, you know, the size of our sun or smaller, tens of billions, hundreds of billions, trillions of years back in time or light years away, you can confidently say, well, that star is probably still there unless it's like right at the tail end.
How can you be confident about that, though? Well, we haven't been observing for 10 billion years.
You're right. But we're just making the assumption that if, you know, if you're looking at a star, its average age is something like 10 billion years. And if we don't have any evidence to suggest that it's towards the end of that 10 billion year life frame, then we can probably look at it and say, well, you know, it's probably still there. We haven't been around that long to see it. And that's based on its distance, right? If it's in our galaxy is 100,000 light years wide. So as long as the age of the object, the expected lifetime, is greater than 100,000 years, then anything you see within the galaxy is probably still there, unless it's right at the end of its lifetime. But we're just estimating based on what we think we can see and what we understand about the object. So the short answer to your question is most of the things in the galaxy, unless they're supermassive stars that are, you know, ready to explode, they're probably still there and exactly as they are right now. But as we look to farther away galaxies that are millions and billions of light years away, things have likely changed very much since that light has arrived at our eyes.
Does that make sense, Austin?
Yeah, that does. Absolutely.
Success. What
is there like a perhaps percentage or something that you could say, you know, 80% we're pretty confident God still be around based on these, you know, exactly what you just said?
Yeah.
Or would you say it's a lot higher, a lot lower than that?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'd be extremely difficult to quote you a percentage exactly, but what I can say is most of the objects that we see with our eyes in the night sky, almost 100%, are still there. because they're relatively close to us. They're relatively bright, and a majority of them are not at the very end of their life. So almost everything, except for maybe Betelgeuse, you could, you know,
more like
see.
Horsehead Nebula. We can travel there right now.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, those
How
are like 1,000 light years
look
away
today. That kind of an idea. Yeah.
Yeah.
How
yeah.
can we travel to the Horsehead Nebula right now, Austin?
Just Chevy.
All right. All right, Weisenheimer. Thank you very much for the call.
Didn't we do that? Didn't we send a car in space and, you know, looped around Mars? No. SpaceX did that.
Oh, did Musk do that?
I believe so.
Oh,
and
I think
he
right.
had the dummy in the car, right? So it's just floating around, and I think it was either headed to Mars or past Mars. I don't remember.
That's
where it
fine
is,
use but. Of scientific dollars right there, huh? That's a heavy payload.
There we go.
Number here is 800-348-2551. Tell you what, Zachy the engineer, let's take a break. I want to find out more about this 100,000 light year wide Milky Way of ours. We'll do that with Dr. Valerie Rapson right after the break. Astronomy Today with Dr. Valerie Rapson. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. If you have a question about the heavens, 800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. So before the break, you said our galaxy, the Milky Way, is about 100,000 light years across?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct? A, how do they do that? Are you in astrophysics confident of that? And we'll start with that.
Yeah. So the answer is yes. From the bulk of the Milky Way extends about 100,000 light years. And then you have, you know, more diffuse material, dark matter that extends further. So it can get complicated. But basically what they're doing is they're looking at supernova variable stars that are useful for calculating distances to far away galaxies. We can see those objects within our own Milky Way and measure the much closer distances that way. So if you look, usually it's Cepheid variable stars. If you see a star that's brightening and dimming over time and you believe it to be at the other edge of the galaxy, you can do the distance calculation and be like, oh, it's a, you know, 50,000 light years away. So it starts to give you a sense of how big our galaxy is.
Now, our galaxy is what shape? Disk, is it?
Yeah, it's a spiral galaxy, and it's flat like a pancake. It's a disk galaxy.
So when we look, if you're lucky enough to be in a very dark spot,
mm-hmm.
or relatively dark spot, you will see why they call it the Milky Way.
Mm-hmm.
And when we are looking at that, if you're lucky enough to see it, we're looking at not the middle, but the edge.
Well, you're looking through the disk of the galaxy. I mean, without traveling above the galaxy and taking a photo, we know it's flat and disk-shaped because it only looks like that thin band of milk across the sky. If we lived in a spherical galaxy, then you would see the nebulosity, the clouds from the whole galaxy in the entire night sky because they would be surrounding you. But when you look through and you see that cloud, you're looking through the spiral arms. And in the summer, you're looking more towards the center of the galaxy. And in the winter, you're looking more towards the opposite direction, the outer edge of the galaxy.
Amazing. But, you know, again, if you're lucky enough to see the actual cross-section or whatever you call it of, mm-hmm. of the Milky Way, that's a very small relatively small part of the sky. Mm-hmm. There are still plenty of stars out there.
Oh,
they're
yeah.
in the galaxy, too.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
what gives?
Well, the actual galaxy itself is about 1,000 light years thick. And there are still stars that are above and below this main area. And you have to remember how small we are, right? I mean, our sun and our solar system fits into a space that's far less than a light year wide. So we could still look directly above and below us and have about 500 light years of stars and disk material to look through. So that's why we see stars everywhere, but they're more heavily concentrated and you see the clouds when you look through the band where the Milky Way
is. So are we on the outskirts of town?
We're about halfway between the center and the edge, about 27,000 light years from the black hole.
So we're on the suburbs,
basically. Yeah.
You reminded me of a link I said a couple weeks ago that I had no recollection of. I said, oh, this will
cool.
be good for the show. And this says, world's oldest calendar discovered in ancient temple, which I believe is in Turkey. It's mm-hmm. this very, very, they're still looking at this, may rewrite the birth of civilization.
Yeah.
And explain why I found that so interesting.
Yeah, you said this to me a couple of weeks ago, and it was all about, you know, they're reanalyzing some of the sketches because this was before written communication.
Yeah.
And they were able to, like, count some markings and things, and what they realized is that there seemed to be a lot of markings that corresponded with the sky. So there was 365 tick marks or V-shaped marks, which they assumed were 365 days in a year.
Yeah.
There were sections that broke things into 12, meaning lunar cycles, with an additional 10 to 11 days to account for the rest of the year. And some of the animal-like drawings even match up with some of the star patterns that we see today. I mean, they might not necessarily match Greek and Roman mythology, but I think I saw in there, like, somebody had sketched kind of a scorpion, which probably corresponds to, you know, something like Scorpius in the sky that we look at today. So they're starting to think that what they thought were just general pictures are actually astronomical calendars. And this is from 10,000 BC. You know, we thought that the very first accurate solar calendars and lunar calendars came about around the same time the written speech was. So that was, you know, 2,000-3,000 BC, you know, time frame like that. So this would date it back, you know, maybe even 8,000 or so years prior, which is amazing.
That's
to think
incredible.
That they were calculating that.
Now, that's the end of the last ice age, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, and they said in there, too, there was a comet strike, we think, at about 13,000 BC. So that comet strike may have enticed the civilization to start paying attention to the sky, because it was a time when they were literally getting rained on by material for like a month. And they wouldn't have known what it was, but they were knowing that something was happening in the sky, and they probably started to pay more attention to it.
Well, this scares me, things falling, raining from the sky. In your planetarium work, are you able to go back in time 13, 14,000 years and find out, okay, well, that's what it was, and it's coming back in the future at this date? Because I'll need an umbrella.
Yeah, some of it we can do. You know, comet modeling and asteroid positions are a lot trickier than planets, because they are influenced not only by the sun, but by every other object that they fly by.
Yeah.
So we can't always model those super accurately. And since this one likely broke apart either near the Earth or crashed onto the Earth, it's probably not going to come back.
All right, that's good.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea that they witnessed and experienced this and that enticed them to be a little bit more scientifically literate was really amazing.
I mean, what does that tell you about human intelligence? And Chris in Turner Falls, we'll get to you right in a minute, 800-348-2551. What does that tell you about intelligence when they've made these observations that apparently, I mean, you have 365 days, you have 12 months, you have the extra days, all of these things. Did people, did societies and civilizations come up with this again? Was this lost, or was this transmitted in a way we don't know, where they didn't write?
I mean, as far as we can tell, you know, back then, it's not like civilizations were getting on an airplane and visiting each other and sharing this information. So it was likely independently discovered in many places, because humans in general, no matter where you're from, are just curious creatures.
But
right?
Why a scorpion constellation?
I mean,
it's everywhere.
Yeah, it is. And like, even today, when you look back at the slightly more modern cultures, like the Chinese constellations, the Native American ones, the Greek and Roman mythology, there's a lot of similar creatures. Like, you know, the Big Dipper is a bear in like so many different mythological stories.
Why?
I don't know. I mean, my guess is that, you know, a lot of people experienced bears in their everyday life. So they looked up to the stars, and some of our constellations do kind of create the picture that we see. Like the scorpion tail really does have this cool, you know, curvy tail-like shape. So they probably made that connection. But how the other connections were made, I think it was just chance, and really cool that we all thought the same way.
Dr. Valerie Rapson is our guest from SUNY Oneonta. It's Astronomy Today. 800-348-2551 is the number. You know, I saw a piece. I didn't read the whole article. I saw the headline. Remember we did the test where we broke off a bit of an asteroid?
Yeah.
Just to see if we could deflect them.
Uh-huh.
No, apparently some of these pieces are going to come raining down in
X number of years.
Did you see that?
I saw the headline too, and I didn't read the full article. But my guess is that, you know, we disturbed something in space, and there are probably going to be really small chunks that maybe come by or get close to us. You know, we don't have anything to worry about. We definitely didn't deflect this asteroid
into
to make it head
path.
Towards Earth. No, we'll be fine.
Because humans never screw up like that.
Well, hopefully not.
All right.
We'll have to wait and see, right?
Let's go to Chris in Turner's Falls. Chris, go ahead.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
I just wanted to ask about the atmosphere. You know, we breathe oxygen, and I was just curious with the vacuum of space, how or what holds the atmosphere in place?
Yeah, that's a great, simple question. So the idea that our planet and some of the other planets do have atmospheres is all governed by gravity and the types of materials. So the Earth's gravity is holding on to the atmosphere and actually holding the gases to the Earth. And the sunlight is actually degrading our atmosphere a little bit. That's why some of the other planets have lost their atmospheres over time. But gravity is the simple answer to why the gases are here. And the types of material that we have, the heavier elements like the oxygen and stuff, they are more strongly bound by that gravity. And that's why they stay. Some of the lighter elements are more easily lost to space.
All right. Thank you very much. Appreciate the call. Having a little bit of a problem with the phones here. Somebody else is on the air. Hello, you're anonymous. Who are you? You.
Me?
Yeah, you. You're
on. Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, I wondered about neutrinos. Do all the neutrinos basically come, the ones we experience, come from the sun?
Most of them do, yes. Because the sun is so close and it does generate neutrinos, the ones that we experience on Earth primarily do. But there are occasionally, you know, massive explosions like supernovas and whatnot in outer space that will generate some neutrinos as well. But the concentration from those is much less than what we would get from the sun on a daily basis.
All right, so when it's midnight local time, and so that the sun is way on the opposite side of the Earth from where I would be, how many fewer neutrinos would be passing through my body than at high noon when it's directly overhead?
Yeah, so not too much of a difference. And the key there is because your neutrinos are neutral. They don't like to interact with things very much. So, yes, they have to travel through the density of the Earth to get to you. But because they interact so rarely, a majority of them are going to make it through most of the Earth anyways.
All right. Thanks for the call. Appreciate it. 800-348-2551. So if neutrinos pass through everything, or mm-hmm. almost everything, why shouldn't they be from all kinds of intergalactic? In other words, when they start, what's stopping them from? Why aren't we seeing a lot of foreign neutrinos, basically?
Yeah. Well, it's really just a dispersal issue, right? Because your explosion or whatever's generating them is so far away that there's no mechanism that beams them at you like a laser would concentrate the light. So you generally have this spreading out of light and neutrinos and everything from these explosions. So when it gets to the Earth eventually, the concentration per area is much lower.
Well, we talk about the cosmic background radiation, which is something different.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we have a cosmic neutrino background?
Well, there may be that to some level, but we're not necessarily generating a ton of neutrinos all the time. And
there are a lot of stars out there.
There are, and they're really hard to detect. So if you were going to try and like measure this, I think it would be extremely hard to detect enough and be able to tell, well, did they come from ambient space? Did they come from the sun? And exactly, you know, how it all boils down. It'd be trickier to see than you think.
I think that it would be pretty tricky. Dr. Valerie Rapson's our guest. David writes in, from a relativistic point of view, what do we really mean by now? I.e., when we think about old light from sources millions of light years away reaching us and what these sources may look like now, whose clock are we using? The sources or ours? Does now mean anything at all at these scales?
Great question. So we really, you know, we kind of take the standpoint of, if I'm talking about time and experiences, I'm talking about my experiences because I'm the observer, and relativity is based on who the observer is and whether or not that observer is moving relative to the source. So we make the assumption that we're the observer, that we are standing still, even though that's not true, but imagine we're standing still and the objects are moving towards or away from us, whatever it is, and we make our observations based on that. So it's based on our clock and our measurements. And it'd be different if we could jump on the back of a photon and imagine what it experienced as it traveled through space. You know, it would experience something different. The time would dilate. It would change as it traveled.
All right. I'll take your word for all this. Andre in Croton-on-Hudson writes in, image of the sky appearing now may not be real, but when Webb telescope looks deep, does it see it differently?
So it does only because what James Webb sees is infrared. So a lot of the imagery that we have so far is based on like Hubble and what our eyes would see. So it looks a bit different. But James Webb is looking at the same objects that we are looking at and that every other objects are looking at. And it's not detecting light that traveled at any different speeds. It's just detecting a different wavelength, a different color of light. So it may look different, but only because the light being emitted is different.
And Webb is what, a million miles away?
Yeah, give or take. Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things, it's right next to us. Mm-hmm. So
essentially, yeah, we're observing from the same basic location in outer space.
Mitt writes in, not purely astronomy. Voyager 1 blinked out and sent gibberish back to us for a period of time. Can you explain what happened to Voyager that caused that? And given the nearly Stone Age computers on board, how is it reprogrammed?
Yeah, I don't know all of the mechanical details of exactly what happened. But, you know, when we have things in outer space, computers fail here on Earth all the time. So it could have just been a general computer glitch.
Yeah.
And these spacecrafts are hit by cosmic rays. They're hit by all sorts of radiation in space that our atmosphere protects our normal computers from. And that radiation can flip bits in the computer and mess things up. So it's very likely that something like that just flipped a few bits and the programming got off. But we can still today send a signal from Earth to be detected by the Voyager spacecraft. And if we send it the right kind of commands, the way we would code things back in the 1970s when they were launched, we can actually just reprogram them. Now, it takes time,
Long time, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. It's got to be like at least a day or something travel time now, like a really long time to get signals to the Voyagers. But we can do it. And as long as we're speaking in their technological terms, we can keep fixing them to some extent and keep them alive as long as possible.
And it's way out beyond the solar system now.
Yeah, yeah. Over 150 astronomical units.
Have there been any appreciable discoveries made while it's beyond our solar system?
Well, at this point, you know, we can't do a whole lot. You know, we can't really take pictures anymore. We can just kind of get some basic information. But their big thing was when we exited the solar system, we were trying to understand, you know, what's the basic density of particles and where does the solar wind output match the pressure coming in from other places in space? And it's those types of particle measurements that Voyager is still capable of doing. So figuring out exactly what we consider to be the edge of the solar system was its main objective. And it passed it like four times. For a while, that was the running joke of Voyager reached the edge. No, wait, we changed our mind. It reached the edge again. And it just kind of, you know, kept going. But I think we have confidently settled on a few years ago, it finally left the edge of the solar system. So now we have an experimental test of where exactly the edge of our solar system should be.
Amazing. All right, we have time for maybe a quickie here. Paul in Bennington, you're on. Hello? Hello, Paul. Okay.
I can see his question up there.
Paul's question was, galaxies and hurricanes are the same shape. Why?
Yeah. I think really that just boils down to basic physics. When you spin something, conservation of momentum and energy says it's going to flatten out into a disk. And we are seeing spinning motions in outer space, which create these spiral galaxy structures. And we are seeing spinning motion in our atmosphere that is generating tornadoes and hurricanes. So they end up having similar shapes. And that's just basic laws of physics. There's no big conspiracy about galaxies and hurricanes looking the same. It proves that the laws of physics apply on small scales and big scales.
All right. We only have a minute here, Valerie, but this email from Susan, how do the bursts from the sun connect to the aurora borealis?
So that's really solar wind, what we're talking about. So the sun will have solar flares. It has a natural solar wind it emits all the time. And when this material collides with the atmosphere, these high energy particles are going to hit nitrogen and oxygen, all the stuff in our atmosphere, and it's going to trigger those atoms to glow, to emit some light. So when we have a particularly strong solar storm, then the particles in our atmosphere are going to emit excess light. And if we're lucky, we can step outside and actually see that red and green glow. Most of the time, you have to take a long exposure picture.
Have you seen, have you had any luck over the summer?
Not really.
There were some beautiful pictures, taken around here. People were out looking at the meteor shower.
It was like in May, like the 3 days that I went and visited family down in Georgia. And I was like, the one time I go south and I'd miss the aurora. But the sun is about to reach its peak again. We're headed towards solar maximum in 2025. So the chances of good aurora are going to be high for the next couple of years. So I got my fingers crossed.
Well, you'll be out there at the observatory, and you should be in the dark.
Definitely. So I'm going to keep an eye out in the north, maybe just keep taking some random pictures in that direction and see what I get, because you never know. Oftentimes the aurora are there, but you just can't see them with your eyes. So you just got to take a picture and see what you can get.
Light pollution is a terrible thing.
It is.
All right. Now, Dr. Rapson, is there any chance for the public to see any of these planetarium shows over at SUNY Oneonta?
Yeah, definitely. Starting next week, we're going to have planetarium shows Saturday mornings as well as every other Friday evening. So SUNY Oneonta's planetarium website's the place to go. Tickets will be up soon.
Cool. And that's oneonta.edu?
Yes. Yes. Oneonta.edu. And then just search planetarium, you'll get there.
All right, listen, a lot of fun today. We'll see you next month. Bob Berman hopefully will be with us. He kind of bailed very late in the day.
Okay.
And we'll see you next month.
Sounds
I think it's
good.
The 26th. Support
Thanks.
Comes from Plaza Travel Center, presenting trips escorted by owner Gene Gagnon. A trip to Japan in October and to Scotland in April. For trip details, Gene at plazatravel.net. And the Lake George Land Conservancy, Bolton Landing, New York, protecting the forests, wetlands, shorelines, and ridges that protect Lake George permanently. Projects, events, and news at lglc.org. Once again, thanks to Dr. Valerie Rapson for being here. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thank you for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our engineer. Phone screened by Susie Checkeye today. I'm Ray Graff, and by gum, tomorrow is Friday. That makes it a Food Friday. Chef Gail Sokol will be back, and we're going to talk, I am told, about Basque cheesecake. Well, I don't know what that is, but we'll find out. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.